Welcome to the Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12:31 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 5th. I'm recording a little earlier today because the US markets are closed for Labor Day. I thought we'd kick off with the pound. It's down to 115, but was off the lows in here today. So there's been a lot of pricing in of Liz Truss, winning the battle to become the next prime minister. She made an awful lot of promises along the way, and it's exceptionally unlikely that she's going to be able to follow through on most of them. But it's very likely that there will be price controls imposed upon electricity. When we hear about the troubles that are being faced by small businesses, where lots of mom-and-pop stores and small businesses that employ anything between, 5 and 10 people, and then thousands of those types of businesses, and they are seeing the potential for energy prices to jump by hundreds of percent, which could easily drive them out of business. There's absolutely no way that any government can tolerate the evisceration of the middle class, and it would represent a huge jump in unemployment. So, relative to the dire consequences of that kind of economic contraction, the lesser evil is to impose price controls. At least the benefit of price controls is that they can be removed at some stage. But of course, that's largely theoretical. Once price controls are imposed, they do tend to hang around. So, what they are obviously hoping for is that energy prices come straight back down again. Well, that's not going to be something that happens immediately because Russia has closed the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. So that's put upward pressure again on natural gas prices. So we had a really significant contraction last week. And then the price rebounded in here today. Now it was way off the highs and it had opened up a lot. So this volatility that we're seeing in natural gas, it's implying that investors are torn between the argument for a really significant supply shortage on the one hand and a deep recession on the other. Because obviously a recession and the impact that would have on the corporate sector would have a really big impact on energy demand. So I do think that it's more likely than not we're going to have price controls imposed upon the energy sector. There is also the potential that there will be windfall profits imposed upon the big energy companies. And in Europe, I see that Macron is also talking about exactly the same thing, and they've already done it in Spain. When we then look at those Dutch gas prices, they were also in positive territory today, but then also well off the initial peak. So again, it's the exact same point that there's the real potential that there's going to be a deep recession. So when we start to look then at some of these stock markets, the DAX index is back in the region of the lows over this year, and it was off the lows in here today. So what we have seen is a lot of pricing in of dire consequences, and bund yields have been going up. Gilt yields tested the 3% level in here today, but this has been a very meaningful move over the last 6 weeks. A lot of bad news has been priced in. And the reality is that price controls will bring down inflation. It doesn't mean that they're going to tackle the symptoms of inflation, but they will certainly tackle headline inflation instantly and bring down inflation as it's measured by central banks in a very swift manner. Probably also means that it's storing up potential for inflationary pressures in the future. And what is it that could ameliorate some of those pressures? Well, the first would be a joined-up thinking approach to energy. So Brent crude today was up about $3. It's going to close out the day closer to up about 2. And that was on the back of OPEC announcing a very mild cut to production. But the pressing fears are about a fall off in demand. So obviously there are clear recessionary threats right across Europe. But the much bigger question here is about how deep is the economic contraction going to be in China. The lockdown in Chengdu has been extended in here today. That's been going on for weeks already. They have announced another lockdown in Guizhou, so that's another place. And there are lockdowns in absolutely every single province in China right now. But perhaps more important than that, this is also occurring at a time when property prices are falling and the renminbi is clearly now trending down. Now, in here today, the Chinese administration announced that they're going to reduce the quantity of foreign currencies that banks have to hold in reserve. So that's aimed at helping to try and create demand for the renminbi. But this has been a significant deterioration. The fiscal stimulus is likely to ramp up in this quarter. And they clearly want to ensure that there isn't a rout. But at the same time, the more money that they spend into a weak economic environment against a background of weak global exports, then that's going to put downward pressure on the currency. What I thought was especially interesting today is that the Asia dollar index was at a new low, and it's a new low over decades. We haven't been back in this area since 2004. So we certainly have a short-term oversold condition. There's the potential that we get a little bit of steadier action, but this is a really significant deterioration. It's been falling all year, and it's not just about weak renminbi. It's about the strength of the US dollar against just about every other currency. And then let's think about the Latin America dollar index. Now, this is mostly Brazilian real and Mexican peso. And the real has been among the steadiest currencies around because they've raised their interest rates in excess of 13%. So that's a significant bulwark against selling pressure. It makes it exceptionally expensive to short the currency. And then the Mexican peso hasn't been as volatile as we've seen in other places. But of course, the major commodity exporters as well and oil prices have been high. But China is a major importer of every kind of industrial commodity. So when we think then about the copper price, there is obviously a lot going on here. We had a mild rebound in here today. It was up about 3 cents. And we have a short-term oversold condition. So there is the potential that we get some steadier action. There's a very important change in the global environment underway. And I think this circular argument that we have around copper is perhaps the most important. On the one hand, you have the bulls that say there's going to be outsized demand. We're going into a period of electrification, and that the global capacity for mines is going to have to double in order to meet the demand for copper. So that sounds wonderful, and it should put upward pressure on prices. But of course, the higher prices go, and the entire global rollout of batteries is predicated on costs coming down because of economies of scale. And that doesn't take into account the availability of the commodities necessary to build those batteries. So electric vehicles are expected to reach parity with internal combustion engines for sedans, at least. In other words, they should be the same price as a Honda Civic in 2023. Well, that's only 5 months away. And I don't see any evidence that electric vehicles are coming down in price. In fact, it's rather the opposite. There is a well-publicized meme going around that the cost to replace a battery in a Chevy Cruze costs more than a new vehicle. And Tesla keeps raising the price of the Model 3 and its other vehicles. So they're getting more expensive in response to higher commodity prices. And the battery is far and away the most expensive component in any of these electric vehicles. If we were to see a really substantial rollout, then where is the metal going to come from to create those batteries? Nobody wants to go out and build a new copper mine. And at the same time, you can't build them overnight. They take years. The vast quantity of material that needs to be moved requires railroads, ports, practically whole cities of workers. And then, because it takes so long, you need continuity of governance. So then let's think about where in the world do you have all of that, and then a willingness to get all of that done. And the number of places is frighteningly small. And in the developed world, nobody wants to have a mine like that in their backyard. So, where is that copper going to come from? In other words, if we don't have that metal, you can't have the electrification. If you have the electrification, then you need to change the battery chemistry. If you change the battery chemistry, then you're not going to need copper. So, this is a circular argument. Therefore, we're going to have a tight market where there's going to be volatility, where people are going to think, well, the progression is going to happen really fast, and then you get a bump in the price. Then the cost goes up and demand evaporates, and people start to see that things aren't going to happen as quickly as they thought, and therefore valuations have to come down and come down hard. And then, because the battery prices come down, then people start to get enthused again, and you get another surge on the upside. But that's not what secular bull markets are made of. That's a recipe for exceptionally volatile, rangy environments. So, yes, they will be buys in the dip, and we've certainly had a significant dip. But the bigger question really is about the broader energy sector, because what I find especially interesting is the divergence that we're seeing in the industrial metal miners. So Rio Tinto was talking to the new Chinese group that will coordinate purchases of iron ore in here today, and the share is just about steady in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Glencore is doing quite a bit better. It has rebounded from the 200-day moving average, and it has a clear focus on coal rather than iron ore. And South32 has also been outperforming and is back above its 200-day moving average. Again, has more coal than its previous parent, BHP. And BHP was down in a dynamic manner last week and is just about holding on in here this week. So there's the real possibility that it's coal is going to be the winner, because the more electric vehicles we put on the roads, the more electricity that's required. And that means that you're basically putting the cart before the horse. You absolutely need to increase the capacity for electricity production. That requires massive investment in infrastructure. And at the moment, we have these exceptionally high carbon taxes. Now, I can see what the issues are. There was a really interesting article on Wired.com over the weekend talking about the migration of the white larch north. And they're finding trees that are 30 years old now, way up in the tundra in Alaska. And That's not supposed to be somewhere that trees can grow because the weather is so frighteningly cold in the winter. But they're finding white larch moving forward at about 2.5 miles a year into the tundra. And this has been going on for decades already. So it both signals that it's not a new issue and that the issue is progressing in a predictable manner. So there's been a lot of panicky type of commentary about the glaciers in Greenland, that the melt is going to accelerate, and a lot of that has to do with some fuzzy logic, and really it is about messing around with how averages are calculated. But one thing that I think is probably worth highlighting, and the problem with the science community is that they don't deal well with exponential curves. It's much easier to predict with a logarithmic scale. Anyone, though, who has ever dealt with markets should be familiar with exponential moves, because when breakouts occur from ranges, they tend to go up in an exaggerated fashion. Their ranges are an explosion waiting to happen. And the most drastic prediction that's been made recently is that melt in Greenland is accelerating. Because if you take the last 20 years instead of the last 40 years, then you come up with a much worse pace of melt. Well, that's both fiddling with the averages and obviously incorporating a recency bias. And that doesn't make a lot of sense if one is going to take into account the long span of history. Unless, of course, then this is a change and this time really is different. And of course, that's impossible to know in advance. So then we are looking at carbon prices that are coming down in Europe because the economy is slowing down and you have factories that are shutting. And if they're shut, well, they don't need to buy carbon credits. That's going to reduce the cost of electricity and it's going to potentially create the conditions for an economic recovery, but it's going to have to fall quite a bit from here. And we're in an environment where everybody has to come up with an idea about how to both support economies and also tackle this longer-term issue of climate change. And of course, the big point then is, shouldn't we really be building infrastructure to cater to the needs of the future and take into account the reasonable expectation that the weather is not going to be as predictable in the future as it was in the past, or that we can't make predictions about the weather in the future based upon our experience of the past, and build our infrastructure to cater to that new environment. In other words, weatherize any infrastructure that is built, which of course means an additional cost. But the reality at the moment is that we just do not have that foresight. There is a clear tendency to rely on new technologies that are unproven, to rely on intermittent sources of electricity, which means that you have to overbuild and then supplement with batteries so that you can both store and use energy when you're providing or creating more, and then you have backup when you're not. And that means a massive overbuild. It's a huge draw on resources. So when we think about, are we going to move into more of an inflationary cycle or a deflationary cycle? I think a lot of it is going to hinge on what happens in China. If the Chinese building boom is largely over, that frees up an awful lot of commodities for infrastructure building everywhere else. They were building at Well, it wasn't, isn't there this fantastic statistic that China used more cement in the years 2012 through 14 than the USA did in an entire century. So we're talking about the use of resources on a scale that is literally unimaginable. And that kind of application of resources is necessary to build new infrastructure projects because a lot of that infrastructure is too old and it's going to have to be replaced one way or the other. So this is going to represent a clear need for new infrastructure, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of plans or thinking about how to pay for it. And obviously, these are really substantial challenges. And I think it's particularly relevant then if we just come back and think about the UK, because the UK was an energy exporter until about 2004. And now it's a major energy importer. And that change in the economic condition has made it more difficult to recover from economic shocks. When the UK was an energy exporter, then recovering from the global financial crisis might have been easier. And recovering from the pandemic might have been easier. And certainly dealing with Russia in this current situation would certainly have been easier. So when we think about what are the absolutely necessary things, then also energy exports were one of the foundations for paying for the National Health Service. So one would have to say that a joined-up thinking approach to energy independence is an absolutely necessary condition for rising living standards in the UK, but that's true everywhere. What it really suggests is that we're going to have to spend a lot more time and effort in building nuclear reactors. And those are the most, the clearest way to achieve energy independence. So I think that certainly stands out as one of the most promising. And then, of course, we have the drive towards green hydrogen, because that's obviously something that could potentially get around a lot of the limitations from the availability of resources. But Fortescue Metals was down heavy in here today because it's still an iron ore company and priced as such. It really would be better if they split up the green hydrogen off into a new company. It would certainly make it easier for investors. But with that, I think I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.